I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey folks, welcome. Food Talk here. I think the mic's hot. The mic's hot. The mics are hot, right? Okay, the mics are hot. It's Food Talk. We're starting on this windy, windy day. It's March, but it's getting cold and blowing hard. And I got hosed. So I've been bicycling around New York since 1982 when I first got here. I bought a bicycle, go to 10 speed to save money. I forget how you learn how to live here. You know, either I would jog or run. So I've pretty much done everything, you know, every particular. I mean, I'm still alive, but yeah, I've braked and slid into cars and ran into the back of taxis and almost gotten in fights. And yesterday, but I, you know, it's funny because I checked the weather. I got a weather app on my phone. And yesterday I went to Union Square on my way up to do my workout and chance of rain all day yesterday. All right, whatever. I got like a rainproof slicka on, but, you know, of course your legs get wet. And I buy my fish, I have my ice packs. I'm going to the gym and bump into Alexandra Leaf, who's an old friend, like a New York intellectual foodie. Lives near Union Square. She's big in the chocolate space. I had her on the radio years ago when I was at WOR. And so we were catching up, and then another friend of hers shows up. This is like New York, so like instead of being where I'm supposed to be, I'm like 35 minutes late because we're all just talking. And of course, it turns to politics, and then it's like another 20 minutes. And then it starts to rain. So then I make a mad dash. I think I'm going to take my bike down to, rather than leaving it at Union Square, I'm going to take it closer to my apartment because the F train can take me where I want to go to. And I just got soaked. I hate when that happens. I got so soaked I had to like go home and get changed. I mean, like, everything was wet. It was like everything, socks, like everything was just like, all right, try this all over again. And then today it's like windy as hell. Today was like crazy. If you're on a bicycle today, it was nuts. I drove across town and uptown today and the winds are just crazy. And it's supposed to be like 20 degrees this weekend. Anyway, we had a great show. If you don't like wine, just click the off button, because we are in the wine world last week, this week, and next week. Last week, if you remember, we did a little promo for that Whiskey Live thing, which was last night, that I actually never went to. I had VIP passes and everything. But I'm like, you ever go to those things? They're cool, but it's like there's 1,000 people when you're walking around. Like, I don't know. But anyway, I think they did really well because it's like the 15th year, so I'm sure they did. But we had Pascaline on last week. So great to have Pascaline Peltier on the show. She is one of my heroes. She's brilliant. She's funny. Andy Bennett, her chef, was with us. This week, I'm thrilled. I've had Victoria James out here before. Victoria is, if you don't know who she is, Google her name, okay? Because you'll find out really fast. That's why everyone does these things these days. But apparently, she started the restaurant business at 13. I read this from your bio. She started the restaurant business at 13, so I'll talk about that. She was featured in Zagat's 30 Under 30, Forbes 40 Under 40, or maybe that was Wine Enthusiast, but tons of accolades, because she's one of these like young gun soms that probably, honestly, I think, I've mentioned this before, like, so I'm a bird watcher, and every so often there's like a strange bird that you see that, like, is that a cross between a red tail and a cooper? What is that thing? So at some point, like in the last 7 years, I began to scratch my head because I kept bumping into these 25-year-olds like you and Erin Healy on the floor at Forgione and others who were just so smart and like got your SOM levels when you were like 21, 22. You guys didn't exist. This is like a new species of SOM. It just didn't, you guys, there weren't people like you before. It's a new generation. Smart, young, and stoked. And I've never met this cat, Lyle Railsback, her significant other, who works for Kermit Lynch, who you may have heard of, because if you're listening to this still, that probably means you're into wine. And if you're into wine and you haven't heard of Kermit Lynch, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what you've been drinking, but Kermit started his business in 72, 73, the beginning of that whole Berkeley hippie cool food scene. I think the story has it was like a $5,000 loan and a storefront in Berkeley. And he's gone on to put together one of the greatest portfolios out there. I've always told friends of mine who first come to the city and they're into wine, if you know what you like varietal-wise or region-wise, here's a list of 15 importers. So rather than buying the front of the label, spin it around. And if it says Kermit Lynch or Mad Rose, Neil Rosenthal or Skernick or Savio Suarez or Dresner, or if you're in a bio and organic, if it's Jenny and Francois and Zev, and back to Dresner again, buy the bottles because they really don't have bad wine in their portfolio. So guys, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
I know you're super, super busy. You have to get back to the restaurant, and you're doing something, I'm sure. You'd be doing tasting.
Yeah, he's flying out tomorrow, I think.
To where?
I'm flying to Paris tomorrow.
God bless you. Business?
Business and pleasure. Now, we're in Paris for 2 days tasting wine with a lot of our French suppliers, and then the next day we fly to Corsica, and we're there for 3 days visiting Kermit's 12 Corsican producers.
He has 12 in Corsica?
We're crazy.
How many total are there in Corsica? I mean, I knew David Bowler was in Corsica for a while.
Oh, really? No, Kermit was the OG of Corsican wine. He's been going there since 1980.
Have you been before?
I've been a few times.
So what is? I've seen pictures of some of these vineyards. Some of them just look so gnarly. So these aren't like long, sloping, verdant, green hillsides.
Some are.
Some are? Okay.
But some, I mean,
because of the wind and the weather, I'd imagine you don't want too high and.
Yeah, Corsica is a mountain. It's 2,000 meters elevation, so you can ski and look at the Mediterranean. It's a crazy place.
Actually, has snow on the top.
Yeah.
No, oh,
yeah.
like skiing, like Etna kind of a thing.
But not volcanic.
Yes.
Corsica.
And Etna went this week, didn't it? Etna like blew up or something. I saw a picture. I didn't know that. So Corsica, so it has that volcanic terroir.
No, there's no.
It doesn't. There's no volcano.
There's no volcano.
So it just has the elevation. So you can have temperature swings by day and night. And,
yeah, it's got a big diurnal shift. So
right. Really
cool nights, freshness in the wines.
Right.
It's the polar opposite of Sardinia. So,
Gotcha. So Victoria, tell me, why did you start the restaurant business at 13? That seems like an awful cruel thing for a young lady. I mean, I started at 13 because I was like a punk kid and was asking my dad for allowance because all my Jewish friends got bar and bat mitzvahed. And dad's like, dude, we're Italian. Get a fucking job. Like, there's no handouts here. You want to go to that Cream concert? You want to buy that denim jacket? You know, so I pumped gas, delivered papers, hated all of the above. And then the only thing to do was like pot washer. And then one day, like the hot dog guy calls in sick or something and you're like, I could do that. You put the apron on, and you're like the cold guy. You're like Mr. Garamanger. But that's how I started at 13. Was just like I fell in sideways. What got you into it?
Same. Falling in sideways, I suppose. My family, we didn't have any money growing up. So if you wanted to buy anything, you had to find a way to make money. Mm. Prior to working in restaurants at 13, I had a very successful pet sitting business.
Before you were 13?
Before I was 13, yeah.
What is it with pets? I mean, that might be a girl thing too versus guys.
Oh.
I think. No, just but like motivation. Because like people, I've got two sons. I've never had sisters. Two brothers, two sons. And people ask me, like, how old are your boys? And I'm like, chronologically or psychologically? Because even in elementary school, I used to read to their classes. So we live like a block away in West Cape May. So I would go as a volunteer reader once a week and hit both of their classes. They were 2 years apart. And I did this from kindergarten through sixth grade. So you kind of watched this growth of these kids. And by sixth grade, I could read like pretty cool young adult fiction, some short stories from The New Yorker. You know, the kids were coming on to speed. Well, the girls. And they'd be at the edge of their seat listening and asking. And the guys are just like picking their nose, looking out the window. And I'm like, so already in sixth grade, the girls were like 2 years older. It was like, it was so clear that the guys were like developmentally, whatever we are, we're guys. And I am a poster boy for that. But anyway, so you had a pet sitting business before you were 13.
Right. And, you know, I decided to go legal when I was 13 and start in restaurants. So there was a local diner and I thought it was great. I worked in the smoking section and had a lot of older waitress friends. When other kids were going to the mall, I was helping, these waitresses shop for pantyhose at the corner drugstore. It was great.
That's so funny. And what part of the world?
So I started, this is in New Jersey.
Really? You're a Jersey
person?
Under
the train tracks.
You don't see him. But I live in Jersey. I'm not shitting on Jersey. Jersey's fine with me.
Yeah,
North,
I lived
south?
there for Yeah, this was north. This was in South Orange, New Jersey.
Oh, I lived in Maplewood for a few years. I got buddies in South Orange. Those are cool little towns. Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of progressive, cool, integrated. You all had the same high school, South Orange. You went to...
Well, I never went to the high school there. So then I came to New York and did a bunch of traveling and kind of worked my way into diners no matter where I lived. Because you could always get a job at them. You were a young, cute girl, and they always needed someone who could wait tables and clean out the ashtrays.
And it's funny because you mentioned that about the waitresses. When I first started in restaurants, I kind of got into it because same sort of reason. So now I'm in a kitchen. I'm on the other side of the swinging doors. But you're in with these older dudes, and it's like there's a back then, this is like Philadelphia, we're in Philadelphia. There's like a TV, and they're watching the Flyers game, and the guys are wearing t-shirts and smoking cigarettes. And I remember all the cutting boards had like burn marks all around them from they put the cigarette down to like carve the prime rib and scoop the shit from the Bain-Marie. And the waitresses were like these salty older women that had like, you know, it was like another world. It was like, this isn't my parents. This is like no one I knew. So it was kind of seductive, right? The restaurant world's kind of this cool place.
Yeah, no, especially for a young kid as well. It was just a really like crusty, down-to-earth, really raw environment that was very appealing. And I think Lyle also got into the restaurant industry that way as well. Well,
that was my next question. So we're segueing over
first
to Lyle.
Restaurant, my first restaurant gig was doing magic. I was a magician in the local restaurant in Sterling, Kansas in high school.
Whoa! That's like Wizard of Oz shit. Isn't Kansas? Yeah, Wizard of Oz is Kansas. That's where Dorothy blew away from.
Yeah, it was a town of 2,000 people north of Wichita, and I was into magic, and so I was the...
The way kids get drawn into magic. One of my cousins or nephews is really into magic, too. Yeah. And he's really good at it. Like, I don't know how you do that shit. So you got into magic. You learned all... So how did you do that back then without the internet? How did you learn that stuff
then? You had to buy, like, trade publications and, like, rent videos and stuff. And you, like
VHS
it was really
stuff.
Hard to get... Yeah, VHS. Yeah. And you had to read magazines and subscribe to things and go to magic shops in major cities. And it was very different than today.
So you were performing magic in restaurants, and that got you into restaurants?
Well, no, I was doing that, and then throughout high school, I got interested in cooking, and I was really into food. And then in college, I got a job in a restaurant and tried to get a job cooking the line when I had come back from Europe, and they said, we filled the position, but we need a sommelier. And I was 20, so I said, I'm not legal. And they said, that's okay. And I said, I don't know anything about wine. And they said, that's okay, you'll learn. So...
Where was this? California?
No, this was in Oregon wine country. This was in the Willamette Valley.
That's hysterical. Yeah. What year was this? The 90s?
This was.
It was that chill. That was that funny. So you did all the above.
Yeah.
So you immediately went out and got like Hugh Johnson's books on wines or whatever the hell people were.
Just Maynard Amarine, I think, was the first thing. And reading, figured it out. And then went to San Francisco, worked in a French restaurant. Realized there was more to the world than Oregon Pinot Noir, and haven't gone back.
So. And how long have you been with Kermit?
8 years now.
And what is your purview? What's your? Because I didn't know. Like, I know you sent me the bio, but like, I know like the title. I don't know what these things mean.
I do national sales for Kermit.
I
travel around the U.S. and I sell to our distributors, and we sell to all 50 states. And I personally handle 15 of them, and then do other national stuff.
So you're traveling a shit ton.
I travel a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kermit's just really such a great story.
Yeah.
You know, just start out. Is he still concentrating, as I recall, his major strengths were Italy and France?
That's all we do now.
That is.
Know? Yeah, when Kermit started in the 70s, he was doing Germany and Spain and California. And he got focused early on and stayed focused, and that's what we do still.
Yeah. That's a good story. I like it. And tell me about, we're not in there yet. There's another half to you. You also have a brother, and you make wines.
Yeah, my brother started a label, I think, 7 years ago now called Ludi that he makes with Justin Willett from Tyler Winery in Santa Barbara.
How do you spell Ludi?
L-I-E-U.
Ah,
second word, D-I-T, like the French word for place name.
Right.
Yeah. So they're making wines. It's a project they started in California making Loire Valley varietals with more acid and freshness and... That's
more acid than Loire?
Santa Ynez, Santa Barbara?
More acid than the West Coast. More acid than we're usually seeing from the ripeness and the lushness of the fruit out there.
Yeah. And his wines are...
So Chenin Blanc.
Chenin Blanc and Melon and Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Franc. A little bit of Pinot Rosé. But the wines are, 12.5 alcohol, and they taste like European wines. So my brother and I will go around the U.S. and do these dinners of Kermit Loire side by side with Ludi, and people will taste them and often say, well, which one's which?
So yeah, I had that happen. Well, something like that happened. Not on the West Coast, but I was the first time I met Pascaline, or one of the first times we were. It was between shifts at the Rouge Tomat when it was uptown, and I love being blind poured because why not make a fool of yourself in public? You know, it's the most humiliating thing. I mean, it is what it is. So you just have to. Anyway, I love it. And you met my son, him too. Yeah. Like, actually, we'd like asked to be tortured at restaurants. Don't tell us what it is. Just pour. What do you think? What are you getting? It's like, oh my God, these guys. And we'll go. Anyway, so Pascaline pours me this glass of wine, walks away, comes back, red wine, comes back. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure we're looking at the right bank. It's Bordeaux. You know, it's, I'm not classified. It's a good wine, like third growth somewhere, but just good. It seems to be Merlot Cap Franc. But, you know, kind of done in a reserve style. I'm not getting a lot of, or any new oak to speak of, blah, 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 blah. And she goes, well, no. I said, what? And she goes, yeah, everything was right, except it's from the Finger Lakes. It was Bloomer Creek, Cheval, White Horse. So it was Cap Franc from upstate New York. But it was so European, to your point, it was like no way I'm putting that wine in America, just in any way. It had acid, it was restrained, the alcohol level was low. It just had that real, you know, almost a little of that pyrazine green pepper, you know, kind of that, not flaw, but you get that from Cab Franc sometimes. So can we buy those wines in New York?
Yeah. His wines are represented in New York. And then on top of Ludi, we started a project last year. We're making a wine together that we call Railsback Frere. And we started making a rosé, which was kind of an homage to Lulu Perrot at Domaine Tempier.
I think we've all heard it. And didn't you get to meet her? Didn't I see that as part of your trip?
Yes, I met her for the first time when I was there last month.
How epic was that? She's like 90?
99.
90 fucking 9. Yeah. Oh, my God. I don't want to think about that. Holy shit burgers. She looks great.
She's amazing, man. She's 4 foot two, maybe. And sits at the end of the table drinking red wine like it's milk and telling dirty jokes to us. It's the highlight of the dirty jokes. It's the highlight of the trip for sure.
Well, this isn't FCC. Let me hear a dirty joke that's not going to offend everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much funnier coming from a 99-year-old woman.
I'm sure. So picture her.
But so picture Lulu Perrot with bright red lipstick, 4 foot two, and she's saying that there's this husband who stays out late every night. He's out drinking in the bars until 3, 4 a.m. And his wife's at home alone in bed asleep. And one night he comes home early and then doesn't go out drinking. And he comes home and she's there and she's in bed with a homeless man. And he's outraged and says, what are you doing in bed with a homeless guy? And she says, well, you know, he came to the door and asked if I had anything to eat. So I fed him. And then he asked if we had anything to drink. So I gave him a bottle of wine. And then after that, he asked if there was anything my husband didn't want or wasn't using. And to hear that from Lulu Perrot is just fucking priceless.
Hear from you was pretty good. I like it. That's too funny.
No, but the great thing about her, too, was when we were there, she's so optimistic. I mean, she was telling us that last year she fell and broke her arm on the bathroom floor and was by herself the
Laid
entire
there all night.
Night
telling herself jokes and funny stories.
Just to keep herself so distracted amazing. From the pain.
She's, you know what, though? That's a different generation.
Yeah.
So lived through World War II, lived through post-war France, and South must have been brutal. Yeah, that's like the, I mean, that's Kermit Lynch is, that's like the corner one. I mean, when you read the Kermit Lynch website about Bandol, it's like that's a cornerstone wine for you guys to have in the portfolio.
Yeah, Kermit wouldn't be, I mean, that's so such a part of what we are is Domaine Tempier and Lulu and Richard Olney and Alice Waters, that whole, the beginning of Kermit in the early 70s.
It's the beginning of a lot of things. It's funny because I live here and I live in Cape May. I usually come up Monday or Tuesday and go home every Friday. And then at the end of June, I'm just out of here. I'm not July and August. Yeah. Fuck New York. I spent enough summers in New York. I mean, it's not even a... I'll come up once every 10 days to buy food and go home the same day. Because there's things we can get and there's things we can't get. But wine we really can't get in Cape May. It just sucks. You're in Jersey. Sorry, Jersey. And B, you're in like South Jersey where, you know, like if you want flavored vodkas, yes. If you want rows of like the worst Pinot Grigio, you're in heaven. You know, California Merlots, wines, you don't even know what the fuck they are. The label just has like something on it, like the name of a berry. Then we're all like funny because I hang out at a very specific beach. Like my Cove Beach is my beach. It's where my kids grew up. It's where you can surf, you can bodyboard, you can swim. I'm an open water swimmer, so it's where I swim down to the point every day. So everyone knows everybody at the beach. And one day this summer, there's like this guy, you know, who's my age, and his daughter lives in New York, and she's really into wine, and she knows me from the food show. And then she's with Anne Rosenzweig's daughter, and Anne's an ex-New York chef. Anne was really huge in the 80s, real pioneer female chef in the 80s and 90s. Arcadia was her restaurant. She's a big, big name. She's cool. Her daughter is really into wine, and her daughter knows me. So we're just talking about like stuff, and they're asking me where they can get this or that, and I'm telling them go to this for fish and go to there. And they said, you know, we just got a couple of bottles of Domaine Tempier at Sunset Liquor. And I'm like, what the fuck? Sunset Liquor. It's like used to be a gas station. It's like a minute walk from my house. So it's under new ownership. So I go in there and I just said, this is like a silly question, but you actually have Domaine Tempier Rosé? And they said, yeah. I said, how much do you have? We got half a case. Done. Here's my card. Are you kidding me? I said, do you get this? Said, we get a case every summer. I said, all right, from now on. I went six of them, but it was, yeah, it's really.
If you're a New York sommelier and you're listening to this program, that was a fictional story.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, they smuggled it in from, yeah, it fell off the
truck.
They
got it from Patrick Capiello.
Patrick Capiello, who's in Burgundy now. I hate you, Soms.
He gets all the best allocations.
Well,
Blame Capiello.
I'm dating you and I can't get any Tempier Rosé. What's up with that?
Go to New Jersey, South New Jersey.
The very, very south. Yeah. Any further south, you fall in the water. Cape May is where the land ends, actually. Noted. That's hysterical. Sorry. Okay.
Well, I'll just buy some Railsback Frère then, Rosé.
Railsback Frère.
Pretty similar.
It's the doppelganger for Ben.
So what's your... So what are your varietals? Because she's Mauvais since...
We found...
She's three. What's in her rosé?
Well, it's mostly Mourvèdre. And there's Senso, and there's Grenache.
Those are like 25.
And there's Claret. Okay. But for California, we found some Grenache. 2015 was our first vintage. We found 2 tons of Grenache that we really liked and 2 tons of Carignan. And they were old plantings, some of the original stuff from Zacamesa in the 70s. Mm.
Makes a delicious rosé.
Very delicious.
I'll send you a bottle.
Send me a bottle. Yeah. So anyway, you brought some wines. You were nice enough to bring. Let's pour something and talk about it. And then I want to hear really what I want to do. Shut up. And I want you guys to tell me about the trip.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was kind of like one of the cool things, I guess. I was really late to getting into social media because I am not that kind of person. Like, I really don't want people to know where I am every night, every minute. I don't feel like that's not how my generation communicates. But then I was told by everyone that does business with me that you have to be on social media, that if you don't, fuck you. So, okay, I got on social media. I got on Instagram like 12 months ago.
I've seen your Tinder profile.
Yeah, baby. Me and Vladimir. I love shots with the shirt off. I'm afraid of horses, but I've been on a couple of horses with my shirt off, as long as they don't move.
Yeah.
You never see like a video of me.
Plenty of saran wrap.
He's not kidding. He Googled that shit. Yeah.
Swiped left.
But Facebook is cool because you get to see like the stream of. That's why I know Patrick is in Burgundy now. That's why I knew you guys had this great trip where you were like everywhere. So tell me what we're drinking here, since we're not going to.
Yeah, this is a white wine from a producer we work with in the Languedoc called Sylvain Fadat. His winery is called Domaine Dopillac. He's in Montpérou, and it's all limestone terroir. This bottling is he calls Cocalière. It's a vineyard that he planted with dynamite. He used dynamite for 30 days to break into the rock. It's on this really steep crest of what used to be a volcano. So it's limestone and volcanic rock. Super steep vineyard. He planted it in the late 90s. So it's relatively young vines, but it's white grapes that you'd expect to see there. Marsanne Roussan, Grenache Blanc, Vermentino. But the terroir and the site of this Cocalière is pretty silly.
It's nice. I like that it's not the most well-known Kermit wine. It's delicious. Definitely.
How many wines in Kermit's entire portfolio now?
We have over 200 producers, which means over 1,000 wines.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And Languedoc's a fun area. I was when they opened up their New York Maison back in like 06, 07. They were expanding. Do you ever meet Marianne Lefebvre? She's great. She's great. She's really cool. They had a little office off Fifth Avenue. And so for the first 4 or 5 years, we kind of partnered up. I was their chef in residence, and we did some video with them. So we flew out there a couple of times and like toured the whole area. And it was like kind of new for me to have been there because it's a little off the beaten track. Like Montpellier is kind of the hub, but it really runs from almost the coast of Spain up to the Pyrenees and up out then to the east past Montpellier. And then once you're there, this is a great thing about we'll talk about where you guys just did. But you sort of get a sense of – you can never get a sense of the place until you're there, until you're actually there feeling that sun, feeling that wind. And then I learned, not surprisingly, it's the biggest organic wine-growing region on planet Earth. It's way easily the biggest one in France. A, because it's big. B, because land's cheap. And C, because the weather is just remarkable. It's just, you get that wind off the ocean all the time. It's pretty damn dry. As you get into the Pyrenees, you've got elevation. So they're really doing some great, great work down there now.
That's where Kermit's finding our best values.
Right now.
There in the Loire Valley.
That's the other, I mean, Loire is like, amazing. And then Jura is so tiny, we can't really talk about it because it's like 1% of France. But that's kind of like all I'm drinking is Loire and Jura these days.
And Alsace.
Weird. And Alsace.
Alsace is incredible. That's the biggest, you know, for white wines, serious white wines in the world, that's, you know, for value, forget Burgundy. It's over.
Yeah, and I still have a bottle of Clos Sainte I have not opened because it's like my only bottle. And I'm like, I don't know when I'm it's like, dude, just fucking open the thing up. Just open up one night. Like, you always do this with wine. Like, you keep this one, and then, like, you open it up and it's like corked or it's gone. Or but I don't think Clos is going to go anywhere because it's so steely. But yeah, they're doing. We were there too. We were there. I mean, wines of Alsace are just amazing. Yeah. Got to meet Olivier Umbrecht and the guys from Jos Meyer. And again, a lot of bio-organic because they're kind of close to Steiner in Germany. And it doesn't rain much in Alsace at all. That mountain, whatever that mountain is there, that mountain
range,
the Vosges holds the rain off of them. Mm-hmm. And then you see the pictures of what that place looked like post-World War II. It's fucked up. Mm. Like the old Vigneron were showing me they're going through their photo albums of what, because it was right on the German border. Mm. And even as the Germans were retreating, they were just bulldozing, tanking, blowing up everything. And guys talked about a couple of the older vignerons talked about how they bought land in the 50s and 60s, and one of the things they had to do was clear undetonated bombs off of the land, because that's what it was. And it was still really a bargain then, because I mean, and I think it still is. I mean, for the Rieslings are amazing. For sure. Their Pinot Noirs are great.
Yeah, and when we were we were there actually last year as well, and the 2016 vintage was so horrible for Burgundy and the Loire. I mean, Lyle and I were talking about it earlier. I think the alternatives, there's just not much wine coming from there now. So you can't get white Burgundy, or you won't be able to in the next few years. So you really have to look to Alsace and have these beautiful, Ostertag makes a delicious Pinot Gris.
Ostertag's amazing. He's another one we met. Actually, I met him with Jos Meyer, and Unbeck made a picnic on the THAN on that hillside.
Tan.
Yeah. I mean, those three guys, I was like, fuck, this is cool. Yeah. do we have to do anything later? Let's just go stay here all day. Yeah, they were great.
Yeah.
Cool. So, sorry.
Yeah. After Robert Chatterton retired, Kermit got the wines from Boxler, too, which is really.
Chatterton's retired?
Pretty sweet. Yeah.
That's funny because he'll make comments on my Facebook stuff, but he still has an office in Rockefeller Center or something.
He may have an
office
still. I don't know.
Because he was, I remember his, that label from when I was a kid of, good wines of that Robert Chatterton selection or something. Yeah. It was kind of handwritten, right? I remember that stuff because that was back then. That was that meant that was serious juice.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, Boxler stuff's great, too. Hmm. Let's do this. Let's take a break for Colavita spot, and we'll come back in 3 minutes, 2 minutes. And then I just want to hear about your trip. So you talk about, flying first class on that jumbo Airbus, and how you got on there, and there was the champagne, and then they made the bed, and it was rosewood table. They rolled out, and
or we can tell you the real story.
Yeah, I know that story.
Either way,
coach C
next to the bathroom,
C-27. Yeah, the bathroom that's broken, or the middle two seats on a 3-4-3 plane. Yeah, yeah, next to the two German guys. Yeah, that's fun.
We ordered the lasagna.
Yeah, the vegetarian lasagna. All right, I'll take a spot and be right back. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home? that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. Talk here. My guests are Lyle Railsback, the national sales manager for Kermit Lynch Wines. I assume you've heard of them. And Victoria James, a significant other who is a sommelier on the floor. I have to tell you, I mentioned this last week during the show because I always give shout-outs of things I do, but so I'll just be a little redundant. But we ate, my son and I had a dinner at Pura. I was there once for your pasta thing, a little pasta party, because he was in now. He was rolling out like a pasta section of the menu.
Yeah, we have a pasta tasting menu.
Which is fucking epic. It's really ridiculous because I'm still trying to figure out like what, I'm trying to figure out like what kind of food he's doing, because you have a pasta section and a section that's mandu, which is like Korean for dumpling.
Exactly.
Which is again pasta. Mm. And he makes everything by hand, but that meal was so good. It was so freaking good. He's just such a baller. And I bumped into Richard Kuo the other day, and Richard was the original chef at Pearl and Ash. And we were talking about everything. I mean, just the restaurant, but we bumped into each other on Delancey Street, you know, Lower East Side. It's always where I live, and it's full of chefs and hipsters. And I mentioned Pierre, and he said he ate there, and it was just off the hook. I said, yeah, the guy's just, he's so dialed in. I told him, I said, you know, he came out afterwards and sat down with us, and I said, so the bucatini that were black, like, how'd you, or rigatoni or whatever they were, how'd you do those? And he says, well, burnt onion powder. I'm like, what the fuck? Who does that? Like, how do you, I mean, I could guess how you make it, but I asked him, like, how do you make, like onion brulee? And the answer is, yeah. And then we powder it, and that goes into the pasta. And then for the mandu section, yeah, like, he does all that dough by hand. And, I mean, holy shit, he is serious.
Yeah, Chris Avellone's very talented.
He's great. So we're going to do something with you guys for sure next season on PBS. Let's figure out what and when, but we'll be in soon. So tell me about this trip. Tell me about why you did the trip, the two of you. Is this your first time traveling together over there? No.
It was no.
No, no.
We've traveled, but not. This is a trip that we've been doing since 1992. My boss, the national sales manager for Kermit, is Bruce Nyers. And he came to work for Kermit in 92, the same year he started Nyers Vineyards. And he started going to France and visiting winemakers and inviting distributors from all over the U.S. So now, like this January, we had 28 people with us. So,
Whoa, okay.
It wasn't a romantic
trip. I was about to say, but you did have your weekend in Paris.
Yeah. We had a weekend in Paris, but
up by the Champs-Élysées, that looks well.
And then after that, it was work for 2.5 weeks. We were,
which means up early, getting in the van.
People. We're driving by 8 a.m. and right. We're, you know.
Did you get a driver for that?
Because no, I drove. Me and my colleagues each drove a 9-seater Mercedes van. So we're driving our clients and selling wine, basically. So it's a sales trip. We've got distributors from all over the U.S. and we went to every major wine region in France in 2.5 weeks.
So, insane, and sometimes 10 visits a day, tasting up to 300 wines a day. It's tolling on the body, but a great experience.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
that's. What are we drinking? Because it's kind of, is this bio? It's got like a little bit of like a bready funk on the nose.
These guys are wild. This is Domaine Vinci. It's a small property we work with in the Roussillon. Mm. They're up in the hills, really high elevation vineyards, like 400-600 meter elevation vineyards. This is like old, own rooted bush vines of Carignan. They have 1 hectare of vines. This is from 1 hectare. And they believe that they really want to be farmers, and that if they expand, they have to then hire more people, and eventually it's kind of like a clipboard chef.
And two more donkeys.
Eventually, yeah. So they do everything by hand. They hand label, they hand bottle. It's everything's done the way it was 500 years ago, and it's
really, it's delicious.
It's a cool place, yeah.
It's really, really, really good. Practicing bio?
Yeah, they're biodynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like very little SO2, only at the end at bottling?
They use SO2 at bottling only, yeah. Yeah.
Got some real nice weight to it, too. Delicious. And the varietals were you mentioned? I forgot.
Carignan and Mouved.
Okay. Yep. Oh, from the region. So back to the trip. So you land, what was like the first, just walk me through. What
we meet
highlights?
Everybody in Paris, and then we take a TGV to Nantes. Mm. We do the entire Loire Valley. And then Chablis. Actually, this year we didn't do Chablis. We drove straight to Champagne. And then in one day we leave Puy-sur-Loire, taste Puy-Fumé. We wake up there, we do Champagne, and then finish in Alsace. That's one day.
Woo!
So that was, it's right. We have, you know.
How many producers in Champagne?
We have 3 in Champagne. And we have four in Alsace. And then the next day we went to Burgundy, and our Chablis guys met us there. And we do Burgundy for 3 days.
Yeah, because Chablis would have been like 60 miles northwest of Burgundy,
yeah.
Which is funny. It's a little tiny little... But love, I mean, Chablis, just, again, we talk about, like, terroir and minerality, that limestone, and champagne. I mean, the same thing, like, you're right over that bedrock, and when you're going through those cobs and just looking at, you know, just the fucking story, like, digging through, like, you're just underneath the limestone, and that's, if you look up 20 meters, that's the roots of everything.
Yeah.
That's where all that Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier is digging in.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get that backbone. Yeah, Chablis is great. Chablis is great. So that's like day three you're in Burgundy?
Well, we did two full days in the Loire and then a day of Alsace and Champagne. And then we did two full days in Burgundy. And then the third day we go to Beaujolais. And we do Beaujolais and then the Northern Rhone and then the Southern Rhone and then Provence, Bandol, and then the Languedoc. And then we drive to Bordeaux and then back to Paris.
Insane.
Stop a couple of places for a minute. And I'm just thinking Kermit, and I'm thinking history, and I'm thinking the Four Horsemen, and I'm thinking Beaujolais, because people that don't know wine, Gamay is the grape, and it's a region that's sort of, I don't want to say vilified, but it's so much of the Beaujolais footprint reputation stems from the Beaujolais Nouveau promotions, which is every November, and also from the active marketing of Georges Dubuff, because he's a big player. I'm not going to go into Georges Dubuff because I don't talk about it. I mean, it's a big family.
Well, and he started kind of like Kermit. He started as a guy on his bicycle trying to help the vigneron of Beaujolais sell their wines.
Yeah.
Started as a really great thing. And then he got bigger and started making wine and got bigger. And, you know, they use sugar and everything. They use chemical yeast. They heat up the wine during fermentation. They cold stabilize it. They sterile filter it.
They make wine.
They make something that they call wine.
It gets bottled and labeled, and it doesn't say anything on the label except contains sulfites.
And Kermit, you know, Beaujolais at Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant is a completely the opposite thing.
Yeah, he was one of the early guys with the guys that were really, you know, I'm just... Because I've always loved Gamay. In 2005, we were there for The Harvest, and we did a PBS show on The Harvest.
Yeah.
And Jean-Paul Brun went to a couple of producers that I love. And talking about, like, you know, you had this... But it was Kermit's... He was at the forefront of that with those...
Before La Pierre was Jules Chauvet.
Okay. Chauvet.
Yeah, Kermit met Jules Chauvet. It's in Kermit's book, Adventures on the Wine Route. But he met Jules Chauvet early on and figured, here's this guy who's, you know, he was kind of a micro-negotiant, only buying things, but working, you know, and he was experimenting with making wine with no SO2, making wine with native yeasts.
Back then, right,
70s, 80s,
correct.
And he was older, much older than Kermit. So, and La Pierre studied with him. Pierre Breton from Bourgogne studied with him. So these guys worked together and turned other people onto it, and the whole world's different because of it. It's really cool.
It is. And Gamay is such a great expressive grape and treated well with great farming and not intervention. And as you said, you know, no SO2, native yeasts. Yeah. There's not a lot of manipulation. There's even some guys, I think Jean-Paul Brun is one of them, that does like a Burgundian crush. So it's not carbonic maceration, but it's juice running. But they're just, I mean, they've gone up probably 50% in price in the last 10 years. These used to be great value wines. But still, in the context of value wines for me, those really good producers of great Gamay from Beaujolais are high 20s, low 30s. Sometimes you see them in the low 20s. There's fantastic bottles of wine.
Yeah, and when you meet Foyard and LaPierre, these guys aren't driving Mercedes. They're still... these guys, they're still extreme value wines.
Yeah.
You know, they're living year-to-year kind of thing. And you look at what they get for a bottle of wine and what somebody in the Willamette Valley gets for a bottle of wine.
No, it's crazy. So you started your trip in the Loire, and I've, you know, just a couple of years ago discovered Pépier, and Clisson is his big cuvée, but he's got about three or four others. And, you know, I mean, Muscadet could be really, really, I mean, for the most part, like through the 80s and 90s, it was just like overcropped, chaptalized shit. It was thin. It was acid.
It still is for the most part.
You drink it really cold and try not to taste too much. And then suddenly you come across someone that's like practicing right. He's bio. He's organic. I don't know if he's bio, but, you know, on leaves for a year and just taking care. And then so you've got Muscadet that's like expressive and polyphem and has mouthfeel that's like, are you kidding me? Like a game changer.
One of the most talented guys we work with in all of France is Michel Brégion. He's a guy with a gray ponytail that Kermit's worked with since the 70s. He's in Gorge, and he makes Muscadet that will make you cry. It's
It's another level. It tastes to me, especially with some age, like Chablis, but it's an eighth of the price.
Which is right. We're talking about wines that are in the low 20s that are freaking delicious. Like, I know every summer before I decamp to Cape May, I call up David or Evan at Chambers Street and say, I need a couple of cases, and I want half of it to be Muscadet. Mix it all up. You know what I like. And then I'll get, like, they'll email me the receipt, and it's like, and then you get a discount because it's a case, so you're like minus 10 or whatever it is. But it's like, you know, I mean, there's bottles of wines that I've, like, adored that were, like, $13 a bottle. I'm like, so to your point about these guys being farmers, and not, I'm like, I would say to David, like, look, don't, you know, quote me on this, but tell them to raise their prices. The wine is fucking worth more. I will pay more. The world should pay more. But anyway, it's amazing value.
Yeah, and I mean, when we were there to the 2016 vintage, it's such a shame because Michel Bregian, he makes these single parcel cuvées from like Gorges and Clisson, but he couldn't. There wasn't enough wine to make them in the 2016 vintage, so he had to just blend them in and make his normal Muscadet much better. But unfortunately, instead of charging... What does he charge for his Gorges and Clisson? Maybe $20 a bottle or 30?
Clisson is close to 30. Yeah.
So now he has to, it's his normal Muscadet, so he has to charge half that. And so he's making little money.
The prestige cuvées are going into the blend.
So these difficult vintages, it hurts these small farmers so much. I mean, they really should raise their prices. And I think we're seeing that a bit with like the Bretons, but...
And talk about 16, because we were there, we were filming in Champagne last May, and I had my phone with me, and in between, like, breaks, you go on your phone and check your whatever shit, and someone had sent me pictures of Chablis and of Beaujolais in May, just hail like you couldn't believe, like hailstones the size of golf balls, and then someone else sent a video that they took from one of the hills in Beaujolais of one of these micro storm fronts that was moving in. And you could just see wind and lightning and hail that was just coming down sideways. And I mean, for Chablis, it was a disaster. For Burgundy, it was a really tough year.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we're looking at like 40-50% crop 80% loss.
80% in some places.
80.
Yeah. I mean, in Beaujolais, like Domaine Diachon said that in 20 minutes of hail, they lost 80% of their production.
Right. And those vines, some of those vines are so damaged just structurally that even next year might be a problem in terms of yields and recovery.
Absolutely. It's a shame.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it gives a lot of people an opportunity to maybe reevaluate the quality, raise their prices if necessary. And then as wine buyers, you know, I'm looking to other regions like Alsace, the Languedoc, places where there are a lot, the vintages aren't as varied. And you can find alternatives to Burgundy when there isn't a lot on the market.
Yeah, I don't drink much Burgundy. I mean, I'd love to.
It's expensive. But there's not a lot now.
It's really expensive. There's just not a lot now. I was with, when this chap was, I got to meet this guy who makes this great Aligoté. He was at Discovery Wines. The name was Pascaline. He was in town all week, so he was on everybody's feed. He's got really old vines, really tiny parcels, like less than a hectare. And they're really specific, like terroir-driven Aligoté, which is something that kind of surprised me. But then again, with the age, and he's been organic now, he's bio.
Yeah, Aligoté is a real interesting thing. Eric Asimov's going to do a seminar on Aligoté for this La Palais that's coming up in the next week or two.
Yep.
And he's including a Bouzeron that we sell from Aubert de Valane, who, you know, Aubert single-handedly resuscitated that town, that AOC, made it an AOC. And it's amazing. It's you know, it's that Aligoté Doré that you were talking about before we started here.
Right, because there was a lot of people ripped up the old Doré and Planet Aligoté Vert, which is back in the mentality of the 60s and 70s or early 80s. It was more yield, blah, 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 easier to deal with, and it's just made shit wine.
Yeah.
And the ones that still have old vine Dorés, it produces this really beautiful, structured wine that's super terroir-driven.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best advice in Burgundy is to find the A-list growers and look for their entry-level stuff.
Right.
If you have Bourgogne Blanc from Rouleau, or you have Aligoté from Aunt, or these guys, that's where you find great value.
Yeah.
For sure.
Or just drink Ostertag Pinot Gris from Alsace.
When we were in Alsace, Ostertag opens 10-year-old bottles of Pinot Gris.
I know.
You think you're at a Burgundy tasting. I mean, it could be Merceau.
Who's the little guy? Is he the little vineyard? Right? Really, like, really, he's like,
just like little 5 foot
five.
He's very sinewy and chiseled.
Really sinewy, really energetic. Yeah, he was so much fun. Because on the other side was Umbrecht, who's like 6 foot six. He looks like Lurch. He's got this big head, and he's this big guy. And we got him, and he got Osterdag. And I'm like, whoa.
Kind these guys representative of their two wine styles, too. It's
very, actually, right. Yeah. One's way linear, way tighter, kind of more austere, dialed in, versus rounder, right. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, those guys are great. So what were some of the aha moments from these trips? Because there's always this thing when, you know, you're putting a shovel in the ground, or you're tasting wine at the table, or you're tasting, like you said, like a 10-year-old. Because I don't think people realize, like, these, like, you don't think of Riesling as, well, now we all do. I'm not going to say something stupid, but these wines are super age-worthy. You've got that much acid and structure, and you have wines that I keep seeing, like, even Chenin Blanc. Like, Pascaline will show these pictures of, like, you know, 59 Chenin Blanc that she had. She poured me one day. And comes over, I'm at Rouge, pours this. What is it? I says, okay. So it's Chenin, and that's Mollo style. It's delicious. It's fresh. She said, how old is it? I said, Pascaline, that's the shit you do. It's the vintages. I don't fucking know. I got the grape in the region and the style. I'm done. 1959, my friend. What the fuck? Yeah, really? Yeah. And it was as alive as it was crazy.
Yeah,
or like old Sancerre Rouge from Reverdy. It's crazy. It tastes like really beautiful, austere, delicate red Burgundy. There's so many values to be found within the Kermit portfolio, I think, from these smaller producers.
Kermit says that the first vineyards he ever saw in France, he took a train to Beaune, and the first actual vineyard he ever saw was Le Monrachet. And he quickly learned that if you're looking for value, you can't you can't look where everyone else is looking. And that's the big takeaway, is that Kermit in the 70s started going to these places that no one gave a shit about. Cote Roti, Bandol, Cornas. He had to give those wines away.
It's so funny because as you're mentioning them now, and we're now, just like ballers. Right.
Now we have people angry that they can't get Klopp and Allemand, but for years he had to give that shit away.
That's Kermit's
another
story.
World. It's looking where people aren't looking. So now what do? You go to the Languedoc. You go, because the Languedoc, people think it's this big place that makes $9 wine, and that's the end of the story.
Because it had been. The history was when France lost Algeria, where they used to get a lot of their bulk wine made, they went to the next thing they had under their flag, which was a big place that had tons of potential, but they planted in all the wrong places, and just, it was France's attempt to make Algerian table wine in France that would sell for a euro a liter. And then, in the 90s, to your point, I think a lot of winemakers began to look at it and just say, why aren't we here? So Kermit was part of that, too.
Oh, Kermit was really early in the Languedoc. He started promoting that before anyone was promoting serious Languedoc wines. You know, early on, we worked with things like Corbière and really good $10 bottles, but now guys like Barral and Fougère, Maxime Magnon in Corbière. Like, these are some of the most exciting wines we have in all of France. Like, guys like this who are changing the game for the Languedoc and Aupillac and Montpérou, and there's a bunch of them.
This is delicious.
Oh, yeah,
haven't got it back my nose yet.
Now we're in Savoie. This is...
It's another, like, gem region. One of my
favorites.
Which
is funny, right? So now you're getting... You're pushing towards, like...
The Switzerland.
Swiss border. You're getting elevations. You're getting cooler climates.
Yeah. This is Chignan. This is right at the base of Mont Blanc. Steep terraces on the side of a mountain. No, most people in this region are not planting on steep terraces, but this is Andre and Michelle Kennard, and they've got really steep, like almost Mosel steep terraces. Like, yeah, this is old vine Mondus,
which is the mom of Syrah. Yeah.
It is
genetically, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I feel like you get those like black pepper notes and spice, but it's much more linear, much lighter, much more structured, if you will. And to me, this is kind of in between Burgundy and Swiss in style. Another gem and such a value.
Was it you? Oh, man. Sorry. That's delicious. Sorry. Pause. Radio pause there. Man. Shouldn't drink on mic. Gosh, that's good. Was it you that poured me that Gamay from Switzerland?
Yeah,
that was hysterical. So I mean, it was like the funniest thing. So my son was at meal, because the meal's kind of running like a blur after, it's kind of all I do. But I remember you brought it to the table, and it was like the funniest Swiss label. It was so Swiss. It was just like a Swiss flag, and it's it said Gamay.
Yeah,
and like that's like. There's no AOC. I don't even know how Switzerland does that.
I mean, it was from La Côte, which is a region in the Vaud, a little bit further north of Geneva. But you know, I mean, I love Swiss wines.
That was Kermit?
No. Maybe they'll do Swiss wines in the future, but I love
it. It was really, really
delicious.
Wonderfully clean. I mean, it was Gamay right off the bat. Like, there was just a Gamay DNA written all over it. But
yeah,
to your point, like light on its toes, not over extracted, not pumped. It was just like clean and delicious and quaffable. And
yeah, and so for me, like the Savoie is kind of like Switzerland in France. And you can get these wines a lot easier. I go to great lengths to get Swiss wines on a list at Piora, and it's not easy. Very little comes to the United States. So right now we have the largest collection of Swiss wines in the U.S.
Piora.
Yeah, but we only have 25, 20.
Drum roll.
You know, because none come here. So so for me, when I can't get Swiss wines, you know, I go to Savoie. And André-Michel Canard, this is one of my favorites. And you can, notoriously, we drink this at Pure with leftover hot dogs from family meal because it is just the most delicious, like, glue, like, easy-drinking glug-glug wine.
Leftover hot dogs.
Leftover.
Come on. Those are specially made hot dogs. You don't have leftover. You have hot dogs on the menu. You can have leftover hot dogs.
Right, yeah.
Probably from the butcher down the street. They're, like, artisan hot dogs.
So good.
So what does this retail for a bottle?
It's, like, $35.
It's delicious.
Yeah.
Freaking delicious wine.
And these wines will age. They'll age for 20 years. They'll taste like Northern Rhone Syrah.
So Kermit still travels. He still has that. As in a couple of weeks, in a month or two, I'll have both Eben and David Lilly here. Huge fans of Chamber Street as a store, huge fans of them. But, you know, they just did a trip together. Same idea. Like the Kermit, they like go meet
Kermit. Yeah, Kermit lives in France half the year. He's
in
got
south
a house.
Of France,
he's got a house that's right next to Domaine Tempier.
Yeah.
So he can always have Bandol to drink. And he still travels around and he's active. He's 75, and he tells people that he's pseudo-retired, but he's still very actively finding things, and we've got people who work with Kermit and have for 15 years that are doing what he used to do, and Kermit's son, Anthony, is involved now, too. So
okay.
His son's going to be there with me on this next trip next week.
Where are you going next week? So you mentioned you're going to go...
Corsica, Italy.
We're in Italy. All over?
All over, yeah. We take a boat from Corsica, and we do Tuscany, Emilia-Romagna, Liguria, Piedmont... Veneto, Friuli.
We haven't talked much about Italy. What have you seen going on? Pick a region and a style, because there's lots going on. I mean, I was in Sicily for the first time a couple of years ago, and everybody's sort of talking about Etna. Is this really?
We don't work with anybody in Etna. We only have one producer in Sicily. They're on the very southern tip. El Loro is the name of the DOP down there. We do stuff mostly in the north, and Friuli is a really exciting place. The wines coming out of there are some of the best in Italy, certainly for whites. That and Alto Adige are kind of neck and neck. But
yeah, Alto Adige, I'm not even sure it's Italy, but it has an Italian flag, although they speak some other language.
Same with Friuli. Friuli feels like Eastern Europe, you know. It's really,
It's funny when I'm Italian, people talk about like Italy, and I'm like, look, until you go there, like there is no Italy. There's it's like a fiefdom. There's like 39 little feudal states that hate each other.
Diversity. If you want diversity, that's the country to do it.
Yeah, and it's really funny. But Alto's funny because, I mean, the first time I went to Alto Adige, we fly into Austria. Yeah. It's the fastest way to get there.
Yeah.
Fly into Vienna, and then you fly into Innsbruck, and then you car over, and you're looking at this place saying, Italy? And everyone's like 6'3" with red hair and blue eyes, and their names are Hans and Franz, and all the varietals. Are like, this is Italy, what? Yeah. You know, Traminer, and really? But it's great. It's a really interesting region.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Did Victoria tell you about her rosé book?
I think we're going to have on. Oh. So we'll highlight that. No. So one of the highlights that... Well, I'll let you talk about it. You got a rosé book.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can talk about that another time on the show. I think we'll do that.
When the book's out, because the book's out this spring.
A little closer, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
But,
we're going to tease that. When's the book coming out?
The book is being published May 2nd. It's going to be
fine.
Published.
I do the show through June, and then I leave. So we'll get you on in May or June. Perfect time for rosé season.
Exactly. So it's being published by Harper's on May 2nd. Lyle here did the illustrations.
I read that in your bio. She sent me your bio.
Yeah, yes. So it's great.
So you draw too? That's like another superpower you have?
He's very talented.
Yeah, I did. The magic and got into drawing in college.
Drawing watercolor? What kind of stuff?
I did just some watercolors and some pen and ink drawings, just simple kind of kid illustrations, I guess.
The book is beautiful. It looks like it was definitely not illustrated by a kid, but it's very charming. So I am very excited to share it with everyone, and we can get more into that later, not to take away from Lyle and the trip. But it was a great project to work on with you.
No, thanks for mentioning it, Lyle, because I didn't space it out on purpose, but I know we're going to have, you're not done this season with me. You're coming back in May or June because it's perfect rosé. And just as a, like, Have there been books specifically just about rosé before? Or is there like a chapter in a book?
There have been, but not for a very, very long time.
It seems like rosé is having its moment.
It is, and right? Deservedly so. It's a style of wine just like red or white wine, and it finally deserves a place on the table. So, you know, I really focused here on very much the, like Lyle said, the Kermit Lynch, Alice Waters, Richard Olney mentality of just the lifestyle of rosé in the sense of this joie de vivre, but also there's something meaningful to it. You know, it's a unappreciated style of wine. So I concentrate on history, regions, producers, but there's also a fun recipe section as well, because what is rosé without delicious food?
Yeah, and it comes, I mean, normally the 16s will hit the market this spring.
Yeah, in a few weeks.
A few weeks, and it's like, we're getting, it seems like, although it's going to get really cold, I think, in a day or two for a couple of days in this region. But I think we're sort of out of, I mean, I had crocuses in my backyard in Cape May 10 days ago, and I'm not the only one, and there's peeper frogs. So I think it's going to be an early spring this year.
Yeah, and I mean, I think some of the rosés, like when we were in Bandol with Lulupe Road, that's, to me, one of the best rosés, obviously, is Bandol Rosé and Domaine Tampier. Yeah. But they're so great because they get you into the red wines there too. Bandol Rouge is so underappreciated in this market, and I think people start with the rosé, and that's how they get into these beautiful age-worthy reds.
Yeah, I haven't. I'm trying to think. The last time I had just pure Bandol Rouge, and it's been
a long
time.
Yeah, there's still a hidden thing. Like Eric Asimov did an article last week in the New York Times about Bandol and the reds, because the rosés have now finally caught on, and we're allocating them. But the reds are more special than the rosé. When you have Bandol Red, there's nothing in the world that tastes like that. There's nothing can do at the table what that does. That's what Kermit's been preaching the gospel for 40 years.
So describe her reds, because she makes a pure red. So is it a blend, or is it all Mourvèdre?
No, by law, you have to use Grenache? At least 50% Mourvèdre.
Okay.
And you can use up to 95.
Okay.
So you can't do all Mourvèdre.
So AOC says half that, and then and then the other blends that you're allowed to mix in are...
People use Grenache, and they use Sanso, Carignan, and Syrah sometimes, but
it's delicious. And you know, not just Tampier, one of my favorites next door is Gros Nerez, and I think that's even better now than
Kermit
Tampier.
Was emailing me this morning about Alain Pascal. He's a guy we work with. His winery is called Gros Nerez. The vines were planted with the help of Tampier back in the 70s, but they just sold fruit. He sold his fruit to Domaine Ott and Pibernon, and then Kermit and Tampier convinced him to start Domaine bottling in the late, only as far as the late 90s. So it's a new Domaine. And the early vintages from him were pretty coarse. They were pretty rough and huge. And now he's really going for finesse, and he's picking super early, and he's bottling on the gas, so it's got a little bit of CO2 and freshness, and he's a guy to watch.
So the first vintages he was picking it later, fruit was riper, higher alcohol.
Yeah, it's easy. It's an easy, you know, Provence is warm, and it's easy to do that, and you don't have to worry about, you know. But it's hard to be the guy who picks early there.
Well, but you see, I mean, Dak, to your point about growing on the West Coast, you see what Raj is doing, and, you know, these guys that are making European-style wines, you know, Raj is, the people are touring, and he says, he's harvesting next week, mine's already in the barrel. Yeah. You know, it's just like, it was perfect when we picked it, that's the style. That's what I'm kind of, I don't drink much California anything, because for so many years the style was just, we know what it was. So... But now I'm seeing there's like that 7% of like smaller, younger vignerons that are planting not the usual suspects. We're not planting Chardonnay. We're not planting Merlot. We're not planting Cabernet Sauvignon. They're picking European varietals that work. And then I guess what you and your brother are doing in a more restrained
and
style.
I didn't mention this, but my brother got into wine more seriously because of Raj Parr.
Okay.
He worked at, he opened RN74 with Raj.
Gotcha.
Got into that whole thing, so Raj is really important to both of us.
Well, that's this cross-pollination. And another thing that I keep, and I think it was Pascaline that reminded me of this one time when I was lamenting, why don't I drink more American wines? We're kind of sort of like new at it again. I mean, we had viticulture was thriving here in the late 1800s in California into the early 1900s, and then the Prohibition was just like the death of it all, and then the Depression, and then World War II. I mean, it was just like all of these sort of...
And then Robert Parker.
we didn't get... Well, and not just Parker, but Cal Davis, and this idea of winemaking suddenly being done with test tubes and vials being, over-manipulated the whole way through, but especially after the crush. And, yeah, Ann Parker with his numerical scoring and this just unending love for fucking these just overly constructed fruit bomb 15-5. I don't know. There was no explanation.
It's good
so
to
now,
see
now it's kind of like so. Now we're almost like third or fourth generation. We're new at this.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't. Now we're learning more about what goes on certain soils and when to pick. And it's right. So it's we're kind of figuring it out. So yeah, I'm trying to really drink more Americans.
Yeah, the comeback of California Rosé, I think, is coming.
It's cool.
And your book's coming. Guys, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having us.
So, Lyle Railsback, Kermit Lynch. Again, my advice to people that if you're exploring the world of wines and you know a style or a varietal, don't buy it from the label design. Figure out whose portfolio it's from. And there's 15 or 20 or maybe 25 or 30 now. I mean, Kermit was at the forefront of this, but there's a bunch of others who are just, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to get.
Kermit's the pickiest importer I know. And when I was a restaurant buyer for 10 years, and my list was half Kermit wines, and you taste a lot of wine every day, and there's other – I used to buy Rosenthal. I used to buy Dresdner. There's lots of other good shit, but Kermit – Kermit is just – he's the best.
Yeah, it's kind of the gold standard. I wouldn't disagree. I mean, Kermit's kind of the gold standard. It's true. And Victoria, great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We had a great meal a couple of weeks ago. We'll be in with cameras and probably this spring for sure.
Nice.
Let Your Chef Know was great, wonderful. Keep it up.
I'll do.
And you're coming back in May or June. Because you've got a book coming out. Pascalina and Alice Firing have a book coming out called, like, Dirty... What's it called?
I don't know, but the rosé one's called Drink Pink.
All right. Theirs is a tongue-in-cheek thing on soil. Anyway, thanks. That's the end of the show. Takes care. And next week, if you don't like wine, sorry about this, but I have one more show. That's all I'm going to talk about. We've got Fred Dexheimer coming in next week. Fred has recently came back up from the South. He was down in, like, I don't know, North Carolina for a while. I don't know why he went down there. But anyway, he's back in New York big time. Fred's one of my – I've known Fred for – I know when he worked for Lauren Turrendale, back when Lauren Turrendale still owned BLT. And Fred got his Master Somme when he was still in his 20s, and he's a kid from, like, rural Pennsylvania who's got so much energy. So Fred and I, the entire hour, are going to talk about wine. If you don't like it, fuck you. If you like it, good. Anyway, thank you. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.